Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Squawker Talker podcast. As you can probably tell, I'm Jake Entwistle, returning to host this week, and joining me is chief writer at Squawker, Mohammed Butt. How are you, Mo?
I'm good, Jake. How are you? Good to have you back, mate.
I know, it's very good to be back, and what a weekend to come back for.
What a weekend indeed.
Plenty to talk about. And who will be joining us talking about that is chief editor at Squawker, Will Hall. How are you, Will?
I'm good. I'm a little nervous because on the last episode I called both of you guys out for your
really?
Eden Hazard 40 goal chat on the previous episode. But, now, so just allow me to begin by apologising.
Well, luckily I didn't listen. So you would have got away with it
yeah.
if you weren't so honest.
Yeah, I just wanted to head off any
bad
any
feelings.
Attacks.
Well, now plenty are going to be coming your way because we're going to start with what was an emphatic victory by Spurs at Wembley against Chelsea. And the one standout stat that we've picked for that game to kick things off is the number 246, which is the number of passes Chelsea played in the first half, and that's the fewest they've managed in the first 45 minutes. And this stat isn't the only one. I've got plenty to reel off, but before we do that, what is that an indication of just how bad Chelsea were, or was it Pochettino just suffocated Sarri ball?
Oh, I think it was absolutely... You have to credit Spurs for this one. I mean, look, Chelsea have shown that they can be stifled previously. United did it to them for a large part of that game. West Ham did it to them. But this wasn't just let's shut them down. This was let's shut them down, overwhelm them and completely render them. They didn't look like Chelsea have all season. I mean, Chelsea haven't been great all season. They've been good. They've been functional. They've been getting results and stuff. But they look genuinely bad. And everyone's talking about, oh my God, Chelsea are rubbish. It's not that they're rubbish. Spurs just played really, really well. They were really organised. They knew exactly what they're doing. Everyone had their roles. Pochettino had sussed out exactly how to hurt this infant Sadismo side. And they did. They did it excellently. I mean, you know, and you know, it was only what 2-0, 3-1. Sorry, it could have been anything.
Yeah,
really. I mean, it was an absolute beatdown.
Well, just a couple of little signs of how dominant it was. Eriksen created 7 chances in that game, which is the most by a player in any Premier League game so far this season. Harry Kane was fouled more times than any player has been fouled in a game this season. 7 chances for Eriksen, by the way. And Jorginho, who's come under fire after that game for his performance. His 43 passes was the fewest he's managed in a Premier League game as well, so not just in the first half. And he attempted 3 tackles and didn't win a single one of them. So was it Pochettino identifying Jorginho as that key part and just absolutely wrecking him that was the problem?
So to an extent, and if you recall the draw with Everton just before the international break, many people identified what Marco Silva had apparently identified, which is the best way to stop Chelsea playing is not to sort of focus on their best player, Eden Hazard, it's to choke Jorginho, because he is a player who was criticised for his lack of mobility while playing in Serie A, so he can be flustered if you rush him, which is exactly what Spurs did.
Nightmares of Dele Alli.
It was just Dele Alli and Kane to some extent, like pressing him, and then you had Sissoko kind of coming at him from the other, for the other side, just to mop up those balls. And I think it's obviously worth a word on Sissoko. I know you've identified the Eriksen stat, and he was immense. Like that chipped sort of cutback for the Son second chance of the game.
Yeah, the volley.
One of my favourite moments of the game. But Sissoko obviously is being rightly praised for his improvement in recent weeks. And it's interesting to think back to his days at Newcastle, where he was first and foremost a creative player. He always sort of figured quite high up in the rankings tables for chances creative. Against Chelsea, he created for Spurs by destroying against Chelsea. And Maurizio Sarri said after the game, Spurs are one of the best teams in Europe for those sort of like deep counter-attacks.
Yeah.
It basically what is sort of a lot of people define sort of gegenpressing or high pressing as... A high press can be as effective as a number 10 because you're winning the ball and initiating plays.
Yeah, well, there's just so much more space, especially with Sarri's team. They're clusters of the little triangles they build on that left hand side.
Perfect for
Sissoko, just to sort of highlight how good he was. He won every single header. He completed every single take on he attempted. And every tackle he made as well was successful.
Exactly. And so the point I'm making is by doing all of that, which you've just listed, he was creating for Spurs.
Yeah.
And I think that was basically the key to the way they won the game, really.
It was 10 recoveries, and it was those recoveries that it was like when...
It's like turnover, basically.
Yeah, when Spurs' quartet of doom up front smothered Jorginho. Yeah,
exactly.
If he managed to squeeze the ball out, it wasn't then going to Kante or Kovacic or Hazard, it was going to Sissoko, and then he was relaunching it.
You get Klopp and Guardiola talking quite frequently during their own adaptation to the Premier League about how important it is to win the second ball in the Premier League. I think Sarri's finding that out.
Yeah, I think obviously after the game there was a lot of talk among the pundits and everything about how I can't believe Kante isn't playing holding midfield, and of course you can understand how they reached a conclusion on the basis of the fact that Jorginho very clearly was defensively exposed by Spurs, because he's not a fast guy, not really a much of a tackler. You know, on the third goal, it was embarrassing, really. But
and there was that one challenge where, well, Dele Alli just threw two step overs at him.
Yeah.
And Jorginho just had to grab him. And nearly started a ruckus.
From the camera angle, it looks like he swung a punch for him. and then you watch on the replay.
He must have just been so frustrated by the fact that, like, I mean, I loved watching that game back again. I almost loved Dele Alli's performance the most. Because it was just, it was so perfect.
If you had listened to the podcast just before, you will know that I picked him out as my player to watch
So. It was exactly the kind of game that showed you just what Dele Alli can do, which is a little bit of everything, but also tactically very, very aware. No, you can give him an instruction to do something and he'll do it perfectly. Like, that was one of the big things, I mean, just about Wayne Rooney. Everyone was always frustrating to Sir Alex Ferguson in both Champions League finals against Barcelona. He was always like, okay, you sit on Busquets. And he didn't sit on Busquets in either game. So... you look at Dele Alli, someone like that could do that. It could be very useful when they have to go to the camp now in 2 weeks and win. But look, I just think Jorginho, right, the whole focus on Kante was obviously, oh, why isn't he holding midfield? The thing is, you can't put him there because then Chelsea won't be able to play Salisma. They won't be able to move the ball. But I think we're talking about, Will said there, you know, you might have to adjust to the Premier League a little bit. And I think one of the adjustments Sally might have to make to his 4-3-3 is maybe to make it from a one pivot and two forward to maybe a double pivot and one forward. Maybe move Kante a bit deeper just so that he's constantly available to help out Jorginho, at least in the early going. Once he's fully adapted,
then Chelsea will become even more asymmetric than they already are, because their one passing option out will be Jorginho, and he'll be situated to the left hand side.
Yeah.
And if he's on the other side, then they're never going to get it to Hazard.
Yeah,
so
no, I mean, it's...
I feel the commentary about like Conte needing to play defensive midfield is really misguided, because as you've just said there, it's not. That position in Chelsea's team is not defensive midfield. Jorginho was asked to do a lot of defending in that game. But if Sarismo works and it's implemented how it wants to be implemented, then you've got Alan, who plays for Napoli, who won all the tackles and made all the interceptions for Napoli. And no one was saying, oh, he needs to play holding midfield. Kante can thrive in that role he's playing in now.
He can do.
As you said, Mo, it's in its infancy, and there still needs to be... The gaps between Jorginho, Kante and Kovacic were too big at times.
Yeah, this is what I was going to say. Basically, Chelsea's positional play and spacing is just horrendous. And it has been all season. We've been saying this, really. I mean, I certainly have, and I know you have as well. It's not something you can just pick up overnight. Even in a few months, it takes a long time to properly learn what Sally is trying to teach them. Now, up front, their positional spacing is horrible. He's still really... I mean, he's not playing Pedro from the start, which I think is a mistake, even though Jorginho Willian is obviously a better player than Pedro. I think it's a mistake because I think Pedro balances the attack very well. They don't really have a number nine who uses the space very well. No. I mean, Giroud does it very well, but then also he's only really ever a decoy. I mean, he scored a goal, but he's not threatening goal enough. Morata has the potential to be what they want, but then he just doesn't seem to put it together.
And he just goes offside.
And, I mean, that was just a baffling display of running offside. He's been offside more than anyone else, right? In the Premier League season, 18 times.
He's topping that list.
It's
more
just,
than Bournemouth as well, apparently. You know,
It's just not good. But the whole Kante thing is, for now, while they're still adapting, what they need to do is at least Kante needs to learn to be a little bit deeper just to protect Jorginho in games like this, maybe. And obviously, once they fully adapt, and I still think Kovacic is the wrong choice to be that third midfielder, because I think he's too similar in a way to Jorginho in terms of the way that he just keeps possession safe. What they need is someone a bit like Barkley who will give them a bit more expansive play. And of course, then not to blame it all, but they do need Eden Hazard to be a bit better than he was. I mean, no, they
couldn't resist.
I couldn't really... No, they didn't...
We haven't mentioned David Luiz, who is probably more to blame.
David Luiz was...
There's a thread on Twitter.
Oh, yeah, of course, the number of goals.
Yeah, 64% someone's apparently worked out.
Yeah, I mean,
their Premier League goals conceded.
We've always known David Luiz is a weak defender, as it were. But what he is you know, he can make mistakes, especially in a back two. In a back three, I think he's perfect. I think almost perfect. But in the back two, yeah, we knew he was going to make mistakes. I think he's made very little compared to normal. But yeah, he's responsible for a lot of their goals conceded. But he's always going to be what he gives them with the ball when their system. Again, it's all about when their system works.
Well, I think the bottom point of this is that Pochettino's embarrassed Sarri here.
Yeah.
Like, in terms of, if we're saying all these players play bad because the system wasn't implemented well, who deserves credit for that? I think,
oh yeah, Poch.
It's in its infancy, but Spurs and the game plan was perfect.
Sarri was critical of the Chelsea players when he was at, when he said, and he said, but he was equally critical of his own system. I think he says he hopes Inter don't take the same approach against
Spurs. I mean, how long you look at it, it's almost like this is a manager, Poch, who's adapted fully to the Premier League now. He's been there how many years now? He understands it, and Sarri is still learning it. And I think what we saw there, and just to point to Soko, actually, I was just because. Obviously, it's his form this season as a whole has been very impressive, and especially lately. And it's almost like something's clicked and he's finally got it in his head, which sounds ridiculous because he's been at Spurs for 2 years. But just remember, it took Eric Abidal about 2 years, year and a half, to really get it at Barcelona under Guardiola. Similarly, very tactically difficult, very tactically intensive system. Abidal was not really that good for the 2 years. Then suddenly he became literally one of Barcelona's best defenders, if not the best defender, along with Piqué. So it's very possible sometimes when there's really tactically intense stuff and you're not always playing regularly, which Sissoko isn't. He's on the bench a lot of the time. It's hard to click, and it looks like it's...
So Dembélé obviously is not signing his new deal.
Yeah, this is...
And that Yeah, it's that sort of mobile. Dembélé is different to Sissoko. You'd like to see Sissoko playing this sort of. Spurs played a 4-3-1-2 sort of thing. Dele Alli.
Yeah, it was kind of.
And he played on that right, which is perfect because, as we've said before, all of Sarri plays on the left. So that's why he got all these recoveries because he was in that one spot. When you look at the average position map of that game, and it's really funny to see that Sissoko. Well, the average position of Kane, Eriksen, Ali and Son is really close together, and they're all on the exact spot where Jorginho's average position was.
Yeah,
so it's really funny how this quartet.
It's clear, like as we said earlier.
I mean, this is the weakness of Sadio in his infancy, is that it all does go through one guy. I mean, he's always going to be the main man, but once they develop it a bit more, then someone like if it's Kovacic or if it's Barkley, they can come in a bit deeper and actually help more, and it becomes more of a collective thing. Right now, they are still very much a team learning their trade. Whereas I think Spurs are as close to the finished article as they're ever going to get until they, you know, sign.
They are close, but I think they do deserve some criticism in terms of playing style for how this season's gone. We've spoken a few times now about the sort of disconnect between the fact that they've got their best ever start to the season in terms of points, but the playing, the actual performances haven't really been at that calibre. The difference is now that team, based on the Chelsea result, looks like a team worthy of that points record, whereas before they haven't.
But then to counter that was the first time those front four had played together.
And it's quite interesting that, like as you said before, Eriksen had this really good game, created seven chances when he's kind of been off the ball recently.
Yeah,
and you looked at that lineup and you saw the absence of Lemayor and thought, oh, is that could derail Spurs here.
But I think it's also...
obviously it didn't.
I think we
so shut up.
I think what we need to consider one thing about the game as a whole before we read too much into it. As I agree with Will, Spurs haven't been that enthralling. But this is kind of the perfect game for Spurs. They've done it before. They broke Chelsea's 13-game win streak.
The tides have shifted, haven't they?
I'm sorry. That's not to say that I don't think... I'm not saying we can expect to see Spurs now regress after this big game's come and gone. I actually think they are a team traditionally that come into their own during the festive fixture run.
They're a very good side.
And they're only 4-5 points off the top, so you can make the case that they're going to sort of figure in the title race potentially.
North London derby next as well.
The festive fixture list is a really good time to just hoover up points and close ground on other teams because the game's come so quickly.
I just think it's this is the kind of game it was made for Spurs in many ways. I tip them to win because this is what they do. You know, streak. Someone comes in with a streak. Pochettino plans for how to break it, and he breaks it. He did it to City when they went 10 games with winning in a row at the start of the season, did it to Chelsea when they'd won 13 in a row. He's just very good at this sort of thing. And Spurs were set up, and like they finally had all their front four fit. As you said, it was perfect confluence of events. And I think, but what's going to be interesting looking forward, we'll look forward later to midweek, but I think it's going to be interesting to see how they follow this up because that took a lot of effort to do that to Chelsea. So.
And the one final point, which will help us move on to the next one as well, is I sort of, do you remember when Man City got beat 4-1 by Everton? I
think 4-0.
4-0.
Yeah.
And that was like, Guardiola's is not there yet.
Yeah. Was that around sort of the spring?
It was the start of the year. It was January 2017.
In that season, Man City, Guardiola won his first six games. Parallels now.
Yeah, exactly.
I said at the beginning of the season that I think Chelsea would finish fifth because I think it would be too hard to implement this straight away.
Yeah,
started really well, and then there are cracks, but they haven't been exposed. Spurs exposed them. So before anyone leaps on being like, Sarri's a fraud, get rid of him, like change the team, it's worth remembering that the best team in the league at the moment, by far, also struggled in their first season under a new tactical, a completely new system and a tactically intensive manager.
Yeah.
So this Chelsea team just needs time, and Spurs didn't give them that in the game. And
that's resulted in that, but that was just sort of
a final point about how if Chelsea stick with Sarri, he'll get more players.
The relationships will build. And we've obviously been quite critical of Chelsea here, and we have produced editorials. Harry Edwards written a piece about the cracks starting to show. Yeah. But I think it's important just to put it in the context of, we know that, it's a project. It's a project.
Yeah, exactly.
As a project manager.
The cracks are there, and it's how Guardiola, when they had those cracks, they fixed them straight away. They filled them and emphatically. Sarri, it's up to Sarri to do that. But we'll move on to Man City specifically now as well. But even more specifically, one player in the fact that Raheem Sterling is probably leading the way now for sort of... Well, him and David Silva, in my head, are the player of the year contenders, and they both got on the score sheet again. And is Sterling the most important player for City?
It always dilutes their... if he is, then he's the best player in the league, you'd have to say. And so he kind of is vying for it with David Silva. Leroy Sané is coming to really, really good form now as well.
No Mendy.
Exactly, yeah.
One theory that keeps proving itself.
I mean, it's true, isn't it? Because you look at how comfortably they settled into it, into their rhythm at the weekend against West Ham. It was like, it's just like last season where Sané plays all wide. Delf cuts in, plays in midfield. It's the whole system, and it works. It's almost more balanced than when they do have Mendy in the side, because when they have Mendy in the side, they don't have a defensive midfielder that can necessarily cope with the fact that there's a guy who just spends the entire time in left wing and there's no left back. And it means that Walker has to spend more time in defence and it becomes a back three. But look, they can work things out. They've got loads of options. Sterling is incredible. I think this is... there was a podcast that recorded that for technical issues wasn't aired.
Oh yeah,
and I'm bringing it back because I'm going to say it. And on that podcast, Jake and I were talking about how great Sterling was and how great Kane was, and we ended up coming to the conclusion that they are England's Messi and Cristiano. One player is this amazing all around talent, dribbling sensation, creative playmaker, scores goals as well, and one is this pure goal scoring maverick. And you know, that seemed really...
Although Harry Kane's performance against Chelsea...
It's not really fair to label Harry Kane purely a goal-scoring maverick. But
the Ronaldo example was the fact that Harry Kane was sort of a man-made phenomenon, whereas Raheem Sterling was born with
it. He looks to be going that way a couple of seasons ago, Harry Kane, where he was just sort of like pairing back his game to just shots.
Yeah.
But then I think we spoke about his performance for England last time and said that it wasn't really the game that you would turn to and point to as a sort of proof that he's the best goal scorer in the war, goal scorer in the world, as obviously
in the war,
in the war,
in the war of strikers,
in the ward of Haringey. Yeah. but it was a very good a testament to his ability as a kind of in terms of hold up player.
Just complete.
His underrated passing ability as well.
Not to distract from Sterling, but just quickly, I do think the one player that actually has the best analogy for Harry Kane is Ibrahimovic. Very intelligent, lots of great positional play, lots of great movement, and a really, really balanced all round skill set.
Yeah, because when Ibrahimovic was at PSG, he dropped quite deep, I remember.
That's the kind of player I think.
He got all those flick ons, like scorpion kicks.
But back to Sterling, phenomenal player. Yeah. And I think David Silva will probably beat him to player of the year because it's David Silva and everyone loves David Silva.
If you take David Silva out, does Sterling score as many goals?
No, he doesn't.
That's true also of David Silva because he's obviously scored at the weekend.
As Will pointed out earlier, this is the City thing. They're going to cannibalize. What happened last year with Kevin De Bruyne? They cannibalized it because they're such a good team that even the individuals that stand out, you're sort of like, ooh, but is it
dilutes their
own claim. Is it not because of them? You know, it's hard because there is no. It isn't Barcelona where there's one clearly exceptional player who even in a great collection of players stands out. This is more like his Bayern Munich side, where it's just like, who actually is their best player? Is it him? Is it him? 1 week is this guy?
Who is it?
Yeah, I mean,
that's what I'm asking. That's,
I mean,
I'm Eric Laporte. That's the best player. And you can make a case for Laporte. You can, you
still
can make,
unbeaten. You can make a case in layman's record.
You can make a case for Edison. You could make a case for Fernandinho, frankly, because the amount of times they played well when he played well.
And foul Naldinho.
Yeah, well, I mean, look at how badly they play when he struggles. You know, so there's cases for so many players.
To back up Sterling, he's the only player since the start of last season with 20 plus goals and 20 plus assists across all competitions. 31 goals and 20 assists.
Yeah.
Sterling and Sane are the only two players with 15 plus goals and assists in the Premier League since the start of last season. And this season, Sterling's had more touches in the opposition box than any other player, 110.
Yeah.
Burnley have had 168. So he's...
Yeah, no, he's...
He's doing a pretty...
He's phenomenal.
Pretty good job.
Another good one is that apparently he's leading the way for fantasy football Premier League points.
That's the one that matters. That's
I mean, I say it a kind of tongue-in-cheek way, but I mean, it is.
Yeah.
That's based on
goals. Well, he's been directly involved in more goals than any player this season.
I think if you go back to the start of last season as well, he's ahead of Kylian Mbappe as well. And look at the amount of praise he gets as a young player.
Yeah, but minutes. That's all right. If you look at minutes played, Will,
let's not
I'm
go
sure.
down to the rabbit hole here. But no, look, I think Sterling is absolutely sensational. I think as Guardiola hinted at after the Manchester derby last season when they lost to United, he was saying, well, once this guy learns how to finish, it's over for you guys, basically. This guy, movement wise, is genius. Use of the ball is brilliant. Dribbling is excellent. His passing is superb. All he lacks is the consistent finishing ability. Once he gets that going, it's gonna be Messi-esque. It's not gonna be Messi. There was no one is that good, but it's gonna be like
Mbappe-esque.
Yeah, well, 30 goals a season. I don't think is. You look at how often he gets into positions to score goals. Cool. I don't think 30 goals a season is out of the question.
Well, he's joint leader of assists with Ryan Fraser, who's having a brilliant season.
Yeah.
And then he's one behind Aubameyang and Aguero for goals.
I mean, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
He'll get so many opportunities because especially when Mendy's not playing. And not like bombing across and like spraying crosses from a little bit closer to the to the touchline, they almost start to play exclusively in the opponent's penalty area. It's like watching a training drill in like an 18-yard box where you've got to keep the ball in here and they're so good at just like picking out all these accurate passes in these really cramped quarters. But that means that like their wingers are so close to the goal that, I mean, they can just score tap-ins like Sterling did.
Well, Sane and Sterling have combined for 9 Premier League goals like directly between each other since last season. 6 of those are Sterling goals, Sane assists. And it's the same thing every single time.
Because they're so close. To, like
Sterling is always behind his defender. The cross comes in and he's in front. Like he blinks forward.
Turn of pace is just...
And Sane's... Raheem Sterling's form is directly linked to 2 brilliant left foot crosses in that team as well.
Like I said, it's the rhythm. They know... Sterling knows when Sane's going to cross the ball. He knows, like you said, he's behind the defender, then suddenly he's in front of it. You know, the anticipation and the movement is off the scale, and it's, you know, he's really, really special. And I think, I mean, we compared him to Messi because he's got all round, but like you look at what production he can get, you know, this guy could be...
Well, the stat that I'm going to look after this will be if Sterling gets like a 15-15... Oh no, Henri got 24 and 20 goals.
Yeah.
Sterling could chase that.
Yeah, he could
24
chase
goals,
that.
20 assists.
That's not out of the realms of possibility, I think, for a player of his talent. And I think that's the kind of thing he should be aiming for anyway, like 20-20 seasons, double-doubles. Yeah. Because I think that's... He's a forward and he's so close to the opponent. I mean, 20-20 is very hard to get, but I think he should be definitely aiming for sub plus 15-15.
Yeah, that's what I was really going to say, 15-15. Yeah.
Because it's like that. You look at how often he gets in position to create chances. As Will says, they play so far forward, so penned in. They're so much better than every other team in the league that he's going to get so many chances. And it's just, I think he can get 15 plus assists, not easily, but I think he could do it. The scoring is, let's see if he can
He's got more goals than assists.
Yeah, no. It's always the thing with him. Can he keep it up? Because obviously he gets into positions because his movement is so good.
Yeah, so that's why I think the goals are much easier. Assists are based on, factors for both, but I think he would be disappointed this season if he doesn't do that 30 contribution equal split sort of thing. He's in a team, he's in the best team in the league, as you said, and everything's funneled towards getting it in the box, and he's in the box more than ever.
But to go back to what I did say earlier, I do think David Silva win the player of the year,
yeah,
because
so
it's David Silva.
Romance.
Everyone loves it, and he deserves it for his contribution to City over the years.
Well, that's what I mean. It's over the years. Oh, of course.
I know it's kind of irresistible to base it on that, but you should really just ignore everything that happens.
I agree with you, but at the same time, what is it? It will be his fourth title. With City?
He's a legend. It'll be his fourth title. The same way that Aguero's never won it as well.
It should be his fourth.
Yeah. It'll be his fourth title. He was a major, major player in all of them, really.
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole thing with his son. And he's gotten better since Guardiola showed up, really.
Definitely. De Bruyne's injury has highlighted... Well, I know Bernardo Silva's been great, and I said that he would be sort of the young
player. Well, there's another player who could be their best player.
Man City is just personal contest for player of the year, but... we were saying that they're the best team in the league by far, and they're 14 points ahead of their rivals, Manchester United, who are closer to the bottom three than they are to Man City. And obviously a 0-0 draw at home. The first time they've ever dropped points to Crystal Palace at home in the Premier League.
Yeah, last time was 1989. They lost at Old Trafford.
So 13 points off the bottom three, all on eight, and 14 off Man City. And is that where they are? Is that how good they are?
That's where they're lucky to be there. They should be lower. They're not a good team at all. They have exceptional talent, but they are just not good. Like, we need to start looking at their performances, like when they beat Juventus and they drew with Chelsea. People looked at those performances like, oh, this is the Man United. This is well done. This is old Man United. But no, we should be looking at this is a mid-table team playing above their level to wreck a better side.
There was one tweet about that Man United-Juventus game that I think triggered everyone in the world, saying it was their best performance in Europe or something. Best result in Europe. One, it's obviously not, because they've won finals.
Yeah.
And two, they got absolutely battered for 75 minutes.
It was classic second half FC, and I did predict it was going to happen on the pod that never existed. But
that's convenient.
If you notice any claims made by Mo,
I've predicted every single Premier League game on that podcast.
That's about Premier League games. I got most of my predictions wrong on that. Although I did call City 4-0.
Yeah, a bit of smoking from Ben, I think, this week.
Yeah,
he's really good.
He did very, very well. I got City right, and that was about it, I think.
Spurs, you got the right, essentially. Well, yeah, 2-0, 3-1, same thing.
Two goals happened at the end. But no, look, the point is, with United, they are not good. They have so much talent in that team, apart from right back, which is genuinely terrible, and right wing doesn't exist. But apart from that, they have loads of talent everywhere, and yet they are horrific to watch. It's genuinely... I'd say it was puzzling, except it's Jose Mourinho in charge, and we all kind of saw this coming at the start of the season. Like, we knew they weren't going to be good. They were horrible last year as well, but David De Gea, as we've spoken about before, had a miracle season.
Hill I will die on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he did, and this season is proving it, because he's still playing well. He's not playing terribly, but they're not... They're eighth.
Well, you can't be a superhuman.
They're an eighth. I mean, you know... What?
They're seventh.
Well, seventh, sorry. Eight? Oh, no, they'll be... Bournemouth could have gone ahead, but then didn't win, did they? They're seventh.
They'd be bottom if they lost all of their games.
I'd processed in my head that Bournemouth was going to win.
I'm just jashing.
But no, United, they're not good. They're not good to watch.
Here's a little one. Marseille, the only top 10 team in Europe's top five leagues, concede more goals than Man United this season, but they've also scored... Man United have a minus goal difference. Marseille have scored 27, conceded 22.
Man United, I think... This is quite interesting, although I don't really know where I'm going with it. In terms of shots on target, I think they're second in the league. Only Man City have more. They've got 77 or something. And also they've created more chances than Spurs this season.
I'm gonna keep going, and I'll quickly look up something to see how good those.
But this is the one that I did find interesting.
Again, they do fit quite well in some of those stats. For goals, they're seventh, exactly. So perhaps that is where they should be.
Actually, I know where I was going to go with this. I think that it's kind of like Mourinho gets a bit of a bad rap for his teams being boring. But my biggest criticism of them this season is how bad they've been defensively. Because if you look at the table for shots faced, which I think is quite a good indicator of which teams have been overall playing well this season, because the three who face the fewest number of shots are like Man City, Liverpool and Chelsea in that order. But I think it's only like five or six teams who have faced more shots than them in the Premier League this season. And so
they're joint
14th for that. Yeah. It speaks to United's biggest weakness, apart from the fact that they don't have a right back and... or really a right winger, is midfield. It's their biggest weakness by far because it's not a functioning unit and it heaps mountains of pressure on their defence. And Jose Mourinho will not play his best centre back for some reason.
Who is that?
Eric Bailly. He's got this great player who took like the
Lindelof been impressive.
Lindelof has been sensational.
And he obviously won a lot of fans with that. He won that sprint with his when he had like was clearly like clutching
when his groin
leg
was hanging off.
He had Townsend and no, it was Ayew and Zaha like closing down on him, which would be bloody scary if you've got
thigh injury.
But one thing also apparent in that clip, and I don't want to go too hard on him because when I was watching the highlights, I did forget about that really, really nice lofted pass that Nemanja Matic played for the Martial champs quite early on in the game. But also apparent in that clip of Lindelof like sprinting back with a leg injury to clear the ball is that Matic is kind of like jogging.
Yeah, this
and
is
not really reacting
passenger
at all. And we've said before, he's not really a defensive midfielder, and he's been successful in that position when Chelsea were winning the league. But he's been previously a midfielder without a true position.
That's their whole midfield, isn't it? Really? You wouldn't be able to say apart from Fellaini and the fact that his best position is in the other is in the opposition's penalty area, which isn't even in midfield. None of them have a you do this, you do that.
There's no definition of roles, which is basically your death knell in the Premier League nowadays, especially in midfield if you don't have it. Matic is never a defensive midfield. What he was in that Chelsea side that won the title, which was 4 years ago, by the way, 3 years ago. But he was the energy and the defence. He was the Rene Gattuso. The guy that played at the base of that midfield was Fabregas. The guy that played all the passes was Fabregas. Matic just ran out and tackled everything, which if United used him that way, he'd still be all right.
But Will's point was that he wasn't even running to...
He's
not getting told to jog, is he?
That's the other thing, But I mean, it's like the part of the thing United have, which is what the main reason why I think they're so bad, is because they don't have a structure in midfield. And I think a lot of that is because Mourinho, no matter how badly he plays, we'll just not drop Nemanja Matic. If he's fit, he plays. And I mean, Paul Pogba has been bad in quite a few games this season, was not very good at the weekend, but he got taken off. Matic was just as bad, if not worse, than Pogba, and he stayed on. And that's been the case throughout his entire time at United. And that's the problem, because at the base of midfield, United need someone like Andres Pereira and Herrera, even the 50 million guy they signed in the summer, Fred. And instead, it looks increasing like they signed Fred just so that Man City couldn't.
What they did with Sanchez.
Yeah, it looks like they thought, we don't want him to sign him, let's sign him. Because they don't seem to actually want to play him at all. So United's defence obviously has issues. Smalling is just preposterously average, and they don't have a right back. But, it's...
The midfield
is where the flaws come, both in terms of attack, because those guys aren't creating chances for their forwards, and the attack plan
their expected goals and expected goals against is pretty much bang on what they've actually done.
Yeah.
So they're expected to score 21 goals this season. They've got 20.
Yeah.
Arsenal, for example, have only been expected to score 18.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they've got 28.
And on that note, remember we've spoke at length about how essentially David De Gea was responsible for their second place
last season.
Based
on expected goals, he saved 15.
And now now his level's dropped to...
Now he's just being normal.
Yeah.
Right, and that's...
Which takes Man United down from like second.
I always find the interesting stat this season is like the top five saves made by goalkeepers. David De Gea is there, and the rest is like West Ham.
The rest are relegation contenders. Yeah.
I mean, this is the thing.
Will's just said Man United are relegation
contenders.
The
funny thing is, I don't even think David De Gea has been... I think he's been good this season. That's the funny thing. That's how big the drop-off was from last season.
He made a couple of...
He's actually been very good. It's just he was so absurdly good last season that it was... Yeah.
That you can't... No one has seasons like that.
Exactly.
Like,
it's skewed
everything. Apart from Messi and Ronaldo.
It's skewed everything. And I mean, you look at...
We've covered Man United plenty.
Basically, just to sum it all up, Mourinho needs to go. They're a wretched team. He's a prehistoric manager. I mean, basically, I think every clip of him talking to the media should be back. They should project behind him. You know that bit in Jurassic Park when the cartoon DNA is talking about resurrecting dinosaurs? They should just play that behind Mourinho every time he goes anywhere and says anything.
Jose finds a way.
It's a strong image to finish. I think we'll wrap up our Premier League reviews there because... I'm aware of timings and spending too much time on the prehistoric Mourinho. So we'll take a trip to Spain, which Mo loves doing. Olé. Talking about La Liga. We'll start with Real Madrid, I think, and the fact that they had as many shots on target against Eibar as Eibar's forward Kike Garcia, and that was three.
He almost got a worldie 2 minutes in as well.
Courtois fingertips.
Yeah, is it Ray Hudson, the Geordie commentator?
Yeah,
it was
brilliant.
Check the clip out, if not for the sensational effort, then also for his reaction.
Yeah, he's always a good listen to, but Real Madrid aren't really a good watch at the moment.
Yeah, no. he could have had a hat trick. Was what I'm saying. That could have been a bit of a panting, but yeah.
Eibar smashed them. Yeah. It wasn't a 3-0 Real Madrid.
Eibar were really good, and also Real Madrid were kind of giving them a bit of a hand, like that hospital pass from Cruz for I think their second.
Yeah.
The Barcelona as complicit, but I mean you don't want to take anything.
Real Madrid are just not a good team. Zinedine Zidane, last season everyone's like, oh, they won the Champions League. Last season they finished 17 points behind Barcelona in La Liga, and frankly if Cristiano Ronaldo hadn't gone absolutely mental second half season, they wouldn't even have gotten that close. They are a terrible team, and they have been for basically since they sold James Rodriguez and Alvaro Morata, and Gareth Bale got fit again, and they dropped and they had to try and fit everyone into their first team, and they lost it. In 16-17, they won La Liga because they could rotate almost their entire side, and they had Alvaro Morata, James Rodriguez, and Isco in their B team. And then when Bale got injured, Isco was in their A team, and they worked it out with their B team. Since they lost that incredible squad depth, they have not been able to juggle two competitions at once. They end up taking games off because they want to rest for the Champions League, and they just now they can't get out of that rhythm. Now the thing is, right? So many times last season, not so much in the first half when they were just terrible. Second half season, they would amble through games and then create a half chance, and Cristiano Ronaldo would score it because that's what he does. And if he didn't score it, and he was rubbish for half of the season, but he would still demand a double team because he's Cristiano Ronaldo, and everyone's like, oh god, he might score any minute now. And when he demands a double team, that opens up spaces for everyone else. And so even if he doesn't do anything and plays terribly, he's helping the team. He's not there now. They have no consistent goal scorer. Gareth Bale has absolutely failed spectacularly.
Scored a banger, but it was offside.
No, I love Gareth Bale. I think he's one of the loveliest people in football. I think he's really nice, but he clearly does not have either the mentality or the desire to be the alpha male top dog. Forgive the cliched sports rhetoric, but he doesn't seem to have that mentality or that desire to be that guy.
I don't think
guy.
He has the calves.
Well, there's also the fact that he can't stay fit. Yeah, but it's just, you look at when he plays, like there are so many games you think, okay, take control, because we know you do it for Wales. But I think playing for your country sometimes has an intrinsic thing that thrusts a responsibility on you that even your dream club cannot give you. And I think that's what Bale has playing for Wales.
But Gareth Bale, like Real Madrid, Rafael Varane, I was ready to give him the Ballon d'Or because I was like, finally, a defender deserves it. Not only is he brilliant, he's won the best two competitions.
Yeah, yeah.
There was one Eibar goal where he was so rubbish. My heart just broke watching it because I was like, what you've done there is lose a one-on-one, they've crossed it in, you've been able to get back into position, they've crossed it from the other side, and you've let a player run in front of you to score.
I think that was the second goal. That was the hospital pass that Cruz played. And then Modric.
Because
I think Varane
had something on the wing.
One. Yeah, yeah.
It was Kike Marine that was like standing up around, dribbled past him, crossed it in. It went all the way across. Came back out to Cucurella on the left, who played really well.
He
crossed it in, and Kike Marine had then sneaked in front of Varane
to score.
It's basically. I think Kike scored their third.
Oh, maybe it was that.
I think it's the first one because that.
There was one goal there that has ruined my dreams of a centre back winning the Ballon d'Or.
Basically, right? You look at last season. The key thing they had in the big games, right? Because they did show up in big games last season. Champions League won it and everything, right? Was Ramos came to play. Right, Varane was, and even when they were rubbish, Varane was really good last season, all consistently good. And Modric was not consistently good, but he showed up in big games again. What happened in the summer is Varane won the World Cup, so he's not recovered from that. Modric performed Herculean efforts to get Croatia to the final, along with even Rakitic, and has not really recovered from that. And frankly, neither has Rakitic, if you look at him as well. He hasn't really played that well in too many games. Without those two, and then without Cristiano as well, those three were three of their five best players. The other two best players are Marcelo and Carvajal, who have both had massive injury problems this season. So without basically three of their best players have barely... One of them hasn't been there, Cristiano. Two of them have been injured all season. And then the other two have just aged horribly or had really bad draining summers. And without their individuals, and this has always been the problem around Real Madrid, without their individuals, they aren't a team. And they can't perform.
One of their best players this season has been Dani Ceballos. And they put him as number six. In this game, and it was like
there's no consistent use. There's no consistent use of Ceballos. They've not brought in, and this is what I thought was so weird about Lopetegui. They didn't bring in Marcos Llorente, who's a phenomenal young player. They didn't bring in Asensio consistently, who is a phenomenal player. They brought Mariano, then haven't really been playing him consistently. It's like Lopetegui is great at working with young players. Madrid had a lot of great young players, and they haven't really brought
them through. We've covered that before about how he sort of went away from what his
and it's just look, Madrid aren't a good team. Madrid aren't a good team, and now what they don't have is they don't have the 50 goal a season striker or 40 goal a season striker, however many he gets nowadays.
Million goal a season.
Lopetegui's goals.
They don't have him to bail them out anymore. And it's like
they've got Bale to bail.
Well, they don't have him though because he's not consistently going to do it.
It's just because you said bail out. Yeah. So I was looking for an excuse.
The fact that they didn't sign Mauro Icardi in the summer is just, I continue to not understand that. Because okay, fine, their main targets weren't attainable. Neymar, Hazard, although Neymar and Hazard aren't really what they needed at all. But whatever, their main attack targets weren't attainable. Icardi was there. Inter just spent a lot of money on Lautaro Martinez. Like, surely you chuck 80, 90 million at Inter, they'll be like, yeah, all right. And he's exactly what they need. He's a striker, doesn't need to be involved in the game, just shows up and scores goals.
Could have tried to swap Modric.
I mean, Inter would have loved
Keeping Modric now looks almost bad.
I mean, it's one of those things.
Like a 33-year-old midfielder.
You have to know when to transition away from great players, right? Barcelona botched it completely during Xavi, but the fact is they had Lionel Messi, who's a cheat code. If Barcelona didn't have Lionel Messi, they would have absolutely fallen off a cliff.
Real Madrid lost their cheat sheet.
Well, exactly. When you don't have your cheat sheet, and it's like then you can't mess up transitions away from great players. And Madrid have got a lot of great players in that team who need transitioning away from. Marcelo, arguably Sergio Ramos, didn't defend very well at all last season, hasn't done so well this season either. Toni Kroos, who looks, he's not that, but he just looks like he's coasting. He's way too satisfied with himself. And Modric, obviously. Benzema is not, he can't, I predicted he'd Wayne Rooney himself, and oh my God, I
just love that every time Benzema plays badly, you have to like, you can't comment on it without fessing up to your Wayne Rooney shout.
I honestly thought, oh yeah, this is it, here we go, we're going to see.
It should have been, really,
acknowledge when I was looking at that comparison, what I didn't think about, because I think what mine was that Wayne Rooney was like 25 when Cristiano Ronaldo left Man United. Or 24 even, I think, whereas Benzema's 30. So it's like, he's a little bit older.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Madrid side needs a lot of work done to it.
Xabi Alonso actually said that Karim Benzema is one of the best strikers of the last decade.
He's phenomenal, and his achievements have been incredible.
He started so young as well.
Benzema. Cristiano doesn't score
those
goals.
When you think of Wayne Rooney at 30 as well, it's like, oh, wait, yeah.
Well, I've always said Benzema was the French Rooney, but like, you look, Cristiano doesn't score all those goals without Benzema, and Madrid don't win those trophies without Benzema. He scored some big goals for them. He can't step up and be a 30, 40 goal a season guy. So they needed a lot of work done to them this summer. And I think Zidane knew that wasn't going to happen. I think that's why Zidane walked away, because remember, they failed to get Mbappe the year before. Like, he was theirs. The guy had Real Madrid posters all over his wall. He loved Cristiano Ronaldo. That should have been an easy get, and they botched it. And I think Zidane saw that and thought, okay.
I've had two segue opportunities here, you keep going on.
All right, sorry.
I'm going to pretend that
haven't spoken.
What
was the first?
I can't remember what the first one was now. But that one was going to be like, well, one French wonder kid didn't make it to La Liga, but another that did is Ousmane Dembélé.
That was worth the awkward way you tried to weave it in.
So there you go. I'm constantly thinking, and I don't think that gets appreciated. So Ousmane Dembélé sort of saved Barcelona at the weekend, despite constant reports that he is not training well and he doesn't being there, etc., etc., that he wants to go back with Aubameyang.
I mean,
or is that that's me reporting that and hoping that, really? But yeah, so he scored the equaliser.
Yeah,
and that is, he scored two of them now this season, last minute, and I think he's won more points.
He's
than
won
any
seven
other.
Points for Barcelona, which is more than anyone else. He won them. Won them the game against Valladolid on that really horrible pitch. He won them the game against Sevilla Sociedad at Anoeta with a goal which they never win at the Anoeta. He drew them level against Rayo Vallecano when they went to win the game. And he won the point against Atletico at the weekend. And also, he turned the Clásico around when he came on. It was Madrid were on top, and then he came on, and they ended up smashing him 5-1. And he won Barcelona their silverware of the season when he settled the Spanish Super Cup with a blistering right foot shot from 25 yards. It's so funny because honestly, the whole thing is Valverde is sick of Dembele because he's not professional and this and that. And he may not be professional. We don't know. The club or someone is leaking these stories to the press about how he plays video games or not, or whatever. But
Mo believes that there's a leak.
Look, but ultimately, look at this, right?
It's not going to be Ousmane Dembele's representatives who are briefing the press with that.
It could just be.
I'm not saying
it is or isn't. I'm not even saying that these things didn't happen. Like, he might well be unprofessional, and he might well be.
He didn't turn up when he heard Barcelona were interested. He didn't turn up to Dortmund training.
Look, he did a similar thing. Not a similar thing, but he fell out with honchos at Rennes.
Well, because he's 21, and this is basically his second full season of football as a first team regular. His last season he was injured, and in Rennes he showed up halfway through the season. But look, ultimately, here's the thing. Dembele may indeed be unprofessional, and that does need to be ironed out. You can't do what he does. But ultimately, if it wasn't for Ousmane Dembele, Valverde would be sacked. He'd be next to Lopetegui in the queue, because this guy has won Barcelona so many games and so many key games.
Won them 7 points.
Yeah, no, yeah,
and, we've got and, a number to it.
And
he
won them their only trophy. Like, they may not have even won the Spanish Super Cup without Dembele. And it's like,
you've said that as if they've thrown away other trophies, but they're still in every single
competition. No, I know, but it's just you look at it, and with Messi having that injury period, Suarez stepped up as well, but Dembele has been just as important as Suarez over the season as a whole. You could argue perhaps more so. Messi obviously is still the Don, but he's clearly so good at impacting games. Now, you know,
I think the best stat about Dembele is the fact that he has 16 assists in first team career for club and country with his right foot,
yes,
and 16 goals with his left foot.
This is
Valverde does keep mentioning that two-footedness. Well, I mean, when he praises him as well.
That's what worked for the goal at the weekend. He was going to shoot on his right foot, and was like, oh, and he faked onto his left, and they all bought it because he can shoot on either foot, and it's such a unique skill. And then that's why he was able to score past Oblak and past their Atletico defence, who had previously been looked pretty much impervious to anything Barcelona could dish out. So there's so much talent there, and it seems perplexing.
Do you think that they will sort of mess this one up as well, and he'll leave?
It looks like these stories are coming from somewhere, and a club that has every intention of keeping this player are not going to be briefing against him in the media.
But even Jordi Alba's come out and said, I don't actually know what the club think of me.
Yeah.
And he, to me, is like Messi's left-hand man
in the context of his contract.
Yeah, but, and plus, Jordi Alba is a bit of a crybaby anyway, to be fair. He likes a bit of a whine.
Yeah, but whine. I keep assisting all of Messi's goals, and I probably have the best chemistry of Messi in our team, despite me playing left-back, and you haven't offered me a deal.
No, I mean, it is surprising. They haven't offered him and Rakitic a deal, but I think they've said that Rakitic isn't going to get one or something like that. But I think Alba, the way Barca do things, it's really weird. They pick one player at a time and then negotiate. I think Busquets is the current guy getting his
500 games recently.
And then, yeah. And
he
then,
signed one. Busquets just signed one.
And I think Alba will probably be next up to negotiate. I think he'll be...
According to Alba, they haven't said anything.
Yeah, well, they better step up, because he's probably the best left-back in the world right now. And I think he's going to... I think partly, maybe they're waiting for his form to drop off so they can offer him they can lowball him. Because if they offer him one right now, he's like, give me all the money.
If Dembele were to leave, where do you see it going?
I mean, Mintis, like, you know, signing before, I think Arsenal...
He says with a smile.
Unai Emery. I think he needs a club with a manager that's going to trust him.
Where do you see him going, Jake?
I've managed to convince myself that Arsenal would manage to persuade Barcelona to get him on loan for 6 months. Because then...
How have you done that?
Arsenal can't afford him. But he wants to be with Aubameyang.
I think Arsenal would be...
Who were the most prolific combo in 2016-17.
Aubameyang's probably a bad influence as well, by the way, because he also went AWOL before he forced his move to Arsenal.
That's why he just wants to come to a club where he can mess about. Lacazette, Guendouzi and Aubameyang is like a French-speaking trio that always have so much fun.
Yeah, exactly.
Dembele wants to go there. He's pining for it. And then, 6 months, he goes back to Barcelona. He's got all of that young energy out, goes to destroy La Liga, and then Reece Nelson comes in for Arsenal. Takes his place.
No, I think the Premier League is a perfect destination for him, because it just suits his wing play down to the ground.
He'll just end up going to PSG.
I mean, God, I hope not. But I mean, you know, we'll see.
Talking of PSG, again, because I'm aware of time, We're going to move on to some quick predictions that will be recorded, hopefully, in this time, and you will be able to use them to refer to, so Mo can't lie about his predictions.
I did not lie.
He does not lie. And PSG have Liverpool, which is the biggest game.
I mean,
Neymar and Mbappe, I'm pretty sure they're going to play.
Yeah, yeah, it does sound like that. I think Thomas Tuchel was...
he said they wouldn't play on Saturday.
Expressed his confidence that they would be back. Yeah, yeah, we didn't play Saturday for their sort of
for their
routine,
14th win
routine,
in a row.
Yeah.
So yeah, they look to be. Although I did read that apparently Di Maria might be playing left wing back.
Oh wow!
Because their Tuchel's moved towards this 3-4-3.
He tried to be quite clever the last time they played Liverpool, and that kind of
didn't go very well.
Was there?
He should play Motta's 2-7-2. Is what he should do.
Oh wow!
Can you imagine?
What a game to rock that out in.
Yeah. Although
the most important game
I
of
read
season.
That I read that Motta was actually talking about it going from left to right, 2-7-2. So two people wide, seven in the middle.
That makes more sense with the goalkeeper being one of the
exactly the
seven.
Yeah,
yeah. That's an interesting way.
So I think that's what he actually meant.
But is there not a way of saying that in like the classic from back to front?
Yeah, but he said, because he was talking about 4-3-3 being, it can be defensive and it can be offensive, and 3-5-2 can be offensive, defensive. And then he talked about 2-7-2. But so Tuchel won't be playing Areola in midfield, or Buffon for that matter. Di Maria could be left wing back, but do we think PSG will reverse the Anfield result at the Parc des Princes?
They're usually good at Paris in the Champions League, and
they were rubbish against Napoli.
Well, they were, but they kind of have to be. Like, they kind of have to. This is like really sort of, this is when we find out what this PSG is made of, because they have to overturn this. Like, losing to Real Madrid in the last, it's in the Champions League. All right, it's not good, but it's Real Madrid. You know, losing to Barcelona, I mean, all right, they got whooped 6-1, but you know, it's Barcelona, right? This is the group stages. Now, I mean, I know they've not had the easiest group. It's not, Napoli is not an easy opponent, but they've only won one of the games so far. They were terrible at Anfield. Lucky that the result was only what it was, as close as it was.
Oh, the group is so tight.
It is. They kind of
even Red Star could be serving up some more L's.
You have to think
after
they
that
will 2-0 actually
win against Liverpool.
Yeah, you have to think they actually will win, purely because it would be so unthinkable for them not to. Does that make any sense? Like, it's like
Napoli 6 points, Liverpool 6 points, PSG 5 points, Red Star or Sverna Zvezda 4.
So I think it's essentially PSG. If they lose, they're basically out.
Because that would be Liverpool on 9.
I think,
but then that depends what
Napoli
do.
My prediction for this one is a draw, a 2-2 draw.
I've just got
a feeling that I don't think the group's going to be decided this early.
Liverpool would be... Liverpool, I mean, no, draw is not Liverpool's away form, the Champions League. They've lost their last three.
Well, I mean, that's including the final.
No, it's not.
Is it not?
No.
So excluding neutrals. You lost to Roma.
Yeah, you lost to Roma.
So away from Anfield, lost the last four.
Yeah. As the designated away team, like not a neutral. They've not done very well.
No,
this is the thing though. It's almost like if they really play Di Maria at left wing back, that means they're going to play 3-5-2. That's almost the dream. I mean,
they play 3-4-3. Do you not think?
Sorry. Well, oh yeah, of course Cavani's fit now. That would be suicidal though against Liverpool's front three, I would imagine, because that's just going to leave Salah in just miles of space to break against Kier. And
Salah 4-2-3-1. Yeah, I mean,
I would play Di Maria left back purely if they had no other options there, because I don't think they'd really do. So,
but
I wouldn't play.
I saw Cazorla back in training. Or something.
I wouldn't play 3-3-5-2. I wouldn't play 3 at the back against this Liverpool front three. They'll just destroy you on the break, and I think they might destroy them on the break anyway. Frankly, but they've got this amazing front three, okay, and Liverpool's defense is good, but like this front three they have the powers and the ability to break them down. Right, it's just a matter of. You got to get them the ball in the good place. That is a lot of onus is going to be put.
Their front three was looked very blunt.
Yeah.
In the Anfield.
They did. This is what I'm saying. Now you've got to look at. This is where I was about to say Verratti has to step up. This is finally like with all the talk about Verratti, how good he is and how amazing he is.
He was suspended for Liverpool game.
I think so. He hasn't stepped up in a big.
Because he had that Champions League ban.
Yeah, he hasn't stepped up in a big.
Oh yeah, we did. Yeah, he was.
He hasn't stepped up in a big Champions League game. Since, if we're being honest, well, the 4-0 win against Barcelona, and then before that, the Chelsea win when they won at Stamford Bridge or drew at Stamford Bridge, I can't remember which one it was.
Mm.
He needs to do it again. He needs the big game because the forwards need the ball, and they're not going to get the ball if he doesn't play. And Rabiot, if he plays, needs to play well. Whoever plays,
I don't think Rabiot's in contention at the moment.
Probably not.
He got booed at the weekend as well, didn't he? Because of the contract. contract standoff.
Tuchel's liking Draxler there. So I mean, if it's 3-4-3, because you have to play Mbappe, Cavani, Neymar. Don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah. You can't rest anyone.
You have to. So then I think Draxler Verratti is going to be the midfield too.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, whoever it is, but they need.
We need a score from you though. Deflecting.
I'm going to say 3-2 PSG just because they have to win. And I think they will.
Okay.
Minus 2-2.
Yeah, just to confirm. 2-2. I think PSG will win as well, purely based on that Liverpool record away. They've looked really uninspiring in their last few games there, so I can imagine like 2-1 maybe.
They do. I mean, in the Champions League though, when it's counted, they have, well, obviously
they love counterattacking. They love counterattacking as well, yeah. And that's what they'll be able to do against PSG. So yeah, high scoring game probably, but I think PSG might just pip it just to make that group even more exciting. The other exciting group is Spurs' group. Spurs are obviously third, and they're 3 points behind Inter, who they're playing. How do we see this one going?
Well, this is another one where it's kind of like they'll both be coming into this game in good mood. Spalletti referred to the football played in Inter's 3-0 win over Frosinone at the weekend as sparkling.
Against Frosinone, though.
Yeah, I know, but I mean,
Frosin Farmony.
True, I guess.
Is the English translation.
I've unsettled
everyone with that.
How do you expect me to do predictions, Jacob? Yeah.
Here's the thing. Spurs should have beaten Inter in the San Siro. They switched off for the last 5 minutes and lost. Spurs at Wembley in 2018 have won every single game except ones against Barcelona, City twice, Liverpool, Juventus, and they also drew with West Ham on the 4th of January.
I thought you were going to say apart from
one. No, but I mean, like, just look at those teams that they've failed to win. They failed to beat Barca, City twice, Liverpool and Juventus. Those are really good teams.
Yeah.
Are Inter a really good team? I don't know. I'm not entirely sure. I'm not entirely sure they are.
And now Spurs have like everyone fit.
And that's
they're
the
in
thing.
A better shape than they were when they went to San Siro.
And there's like they're kind of in a position where the worst has happened. It's like there's, I mean, if they go out of the Champions League at the group stage, then it's almost as though we kind of came to terms with them going out of the Champions League after that PSV draw. Where PSG drew in the last minute, and so now it's kind of like that. Where they're coming back from a worse situation, yeah. And so they've got everything to gain and not nothing to lose. But
Barca beating Inter at the Camp Nou was a huge, huge moment for Spurs. Even though they only drew that game week, they only drew, but that was huge because that meant that knocked Inter back immediately. Whereas if that had been a draw, that would have been trouble for Spurs. But I think Spurs win. I think they're good. They're very good at Wembley. I think 2-1. I think they're very good at Wembley.
2-1 as well. I've got it written down.
On countdown.
This is like on countdown. Yeah. Hold on.
All right, I just said that. Got a parrot as a guest this week. 2-1.
Working out.
The final little game to look at before I think we'll wrap up is the Real Madrid game, who we've obviously spoken about. They're actually top of their Champions League group. They've won all their games. They've won 3 out of 4 games after that defeat to CSKA Moscow. So they're level on 9 with Roma, who they play. I think if there's one player that's going to exploit a defence that isn't very confident, it's
Mr. Dzeko.
Fresh off the back
of Bosnian bombshell.
Off the back of his Reddit, ask me anything.
Yeah. Well, that'll spur him on. But also, I think he joint top scorer Champions League with Messi, or is he?
Yeah, he is. He's joint. And Roma have won 7 games in a row at home in the Champions League. They lost to Porto, and then they lost to Real Madrid as well. That was back in 2016. So they're good at home in Europe. You know, ask Barcelona. You know,
Liverpool won't care. But.
Yeah, well, no, they won't. But Liverpool and Barcelona went there with leads, and both of them lost those leads. In Barcelona's case, they lost it to such an extent that they went out of the Champions League. It's not an easy place to go. Roma are going to be bang up for this. Madrid are in a terrible moment. Like, they beat Roma at the Bernabeu early in the season, but they were playing well then. That was like the last
hurrah.
That was
like the one good game.
That was like,
played,
like the peak of Lopetegui, you know, at Madrid. They're not playing very well. We've been over that ad nauseum. I think they lose this game. I mean, I think they're still qualified because
they only
last,
need a point. To they're qualify, yeah, looking they're, at
and their last game. Their last game is at home against CSKA. So I do think it will come down to that. I think they'll probably have to beat or draw with CSKA to do that, and they'll do that because it's at the camp. It's at the Bernabeu. But I do think this week, I think they lose top spot to Roma. I think they are in such a dodgy way, and Roma are going to bang up this. Roma, remember. Should have knocked Real Madrid out of the Champions League in 2015-16. They should have won at the Bernabeu.
We're not talking about 2015.
No, Mohamed Salah.
We're talking about the score for Roma at Real Madrid in Champions League Group G in 2018.
It's going to be 2-0 to Roma.
I also was thinking Roma win. Stadio Olimpico is not really where you want to be heading in the current mood. But I think it'll be a bit tighter, maybe 1-0.
1-0. Dzeko, winner.
Ramos, howler.
Yeah. I think Dzeko scores twice. I think Varane is not in the mood to handle Edin Dzeko.
Dzeko, like, that was the thing I was peddling when they played Liverpool. It's like Dzeko will be plus the destroyer.
Plus he'll be up for this because he missed.
He played quite well, but obviously
when they played Real Madrid in 2016 and they lost, he missed two sitters in the Bernabeu. Should have not.
But he's involved.
Him and Salah both really messed up. Salah failed his redemption against his vengeance against Real Madrid in the final last year. Well, he didn't really fail. He got judo threw to the ground, but so can Dzeko get his redemption over Meroji? Let's have a look.
I think we all think yes might be the answer. But before we do wrap up fully, as I've had a break and it's the first one back, we'll have 5 bonus minutes on just like what happened with the Libertadores final, and just talking about. So obviously it was the second leg. It was postponed one day because there was a bus attack. And then they said, oh no, we'll still invite all the fans in, we'll play it tomorrow evening instead. Then that's been postponed and there's no date set.
So obviously, Boca bus attacked, a couple players went to hospital.
The captain went to hospital.
One of which reportedly with slivers of glass in his eye.
Gross.
Slivers of glass in his eye. The windows broken as well, obviously left them liable to be affected by the tear gas that the police were using. Although this is according to the reports.
So
Boca urged... the CONMEBOL, which is basically the South American equivalent of UEFA, to ensure that the conditions in which the game would be replayed, if it would be replayed, were equal. Obviously, they couldn't ensure that because of the psychological and physical trauma experienced by the Boca players. So that didn't go ahead. They had to sort of, after they'd started letting the fans back into the Stadio Monumental, then they had to call it off.
Send them back out again.
So all of this in the context of these are arguably the two biggest teams in South America, certainly the two biggest teams in Argentina.
Well, the rivalry itself biggest.
They were meeting in basically what is the equivalent of the Champions League final. It's like Real Madrid played Barcelona in the Champions League final.
The Super Clásicos were like the fourth biggest regular scheduled club game in the world, like behind the Clásico, behind Derby d'Italia into Juve, and then behind Man United Liverpool. It's probably the fourth after those three. It's a massive
it's probably,
game.
Well, I mean, it's probably bigger than all of those in terms of like just how intense.
Did you see the open training session?
That was pretty great. They sold out. I think the local council complained of the fact that they'd overfilled to the.
You look at what we got in the first game. This is the thing. If you watch Superclásicos, you know that a long time, they've been ugly sort of neck. It's been like, you remember the Clásicos between Real Madrid and Barcelona when Mourinho was at Real Madrid? It was just like horrible negative stuff because Mourinho wanted it that way so his side could actually compete. It's like that all the time in the Superclásico recently. And what we got, the first leg that we got was a really engaging, positive game, was just a miracle. It was a miracle that we got that. It was a miracle that it wasn't mired in violence. It was a miracle that there was no fan trouble. What we got here was a sad regression to the mean between these two clubs. A lot of hostility.
An issue a couple of seasons ago, I think, in the quarterfinal where the...
Well, Tevez referenced that, didn't he? He was like, he wasn't there for that one, but then he spoke on the Saturday night saying, oh, they're forcing us to play. And one thing that I really can't deal with is the fact that just like in 2015, I think it was, the River players haven't asked how we're done. And so he was really angry.
Yeah. And they got kicked out of the tournament for that as well.
It's going to be very difficult for the second leg to even... I mean, I don't know when they're going to play.
So there's going to be a meeting Tuesday in which they'll decide when or whether...
Yeah, I mean, they should have just cancelled it outright, and they should have really just awarded the game to Boca. As much as it would have been sad to award the trophy to Boca, that was horrific what happened.
And another thing is, these are two teams who have never before met in the near 60-year history of the competition. They've never met in the final of this competition. Obviously, meeting in the final is quite rare, but so this was like... It's almost like the biggest game in the history of this competition, potentially.
And it's really sad that fan violence and police overzealous use of tear gas has kind of just ruined the occasion. But that it is what it is, and that's the sad state of the affairs down there. I
just thought it was the thing that was amusing me on Saturday, and amusing is probably perhaps the wrong word, is Like the Boca Juniors club doctor on his Instagram page was just posting the pictures of the people that went to hospital and just their eyes and the big bandages he'd put over their eyes. Yeah. And then a letter appeared reportedly from the Commonwealth medical team saying like the superficial injuries suffered. So just like the grazes on the arms and face. And they said, oh, the two people that have gone to hospital, we've not been able to look at their injuries, so we can't actually confirm if they're a reason to postpone the game. And it was like this weird, it spoke volumes to me about the why people sort of, people romanticize about sort of South American football because of what you sort of know and the players that come over and how good they are, when the reality is something that's quite,
it's so
bad. I don't want to sort of, it's so, put my foot in my mouth saying anything.
It's so
here,
badly disorganized. Yeah. And this is the problem. This is sort of, you can get a snapshot of it if you look at the AFA for international football, the way Argentina's Football Federation runs their national side, which is horrifically, like the players had to pay for their own flights and accommodation in the 2016 Copa America, for instance. That's why Messi and Di Maria and that retired after that. It wasn't that they lost, it was because the AFA were just a joke.
Messi's retired plenty of time.
So it's just, you look at, it's a sad state of affairs, but really it could have been handled. They should have cancelled the game straight away. Mm. There should have been no talk of, oh, we're going to play it, we're going to play it, we're going to play it, because that was purely the money talking. It's like, this is like you say, this is one of the biggest games of all time. Let's play the game. It's like, no, they were attacked. Their captain is in hospital. They've been assaulted by the police and rival fans. They should not have to play a game. And frankly, they shouldn't even have to play a game midweek. Not for 2 weeks. This just shouldn't be a second leg. Their game should be called off. It should be awarded 3-0 to Boca as a forfeit, and they should win the Copa Libertadores. And I'm sorry if that doesn't seem fair, but like, don't. You know, I think
the occasion is so grand that now they're. Which they shouldn't be, but they're torn. They're like,
this is
the first time this has ever happened. They can't not have the second game.
They want their showpiece. And this is the last two-legged final as well. Next year, they're switching to a single-leg final. This is their last two-legged final, and basically it's gone completely to hell. So it's such a weirdly fitting end for the two-legged final, which is always a weird concept anyway. So there can't be a second leg. I even if you play it in a month, the players will not forget. The fans will not forget.
Something else is likely to happen.
And if you pick a month away, then the fans just have the troublemaking fans, the one that caused the trouble in the first place, have a month to plan what they want to do. Mm. Like, you're not going to escape. Yeah, and the thing as well is the river hooligans that caused this will now know that Boca can be wound up and upset. And so they will play on that. They will throw something on there. And so you can't play a second. There will be no neutral circumstances where you could play a second.
Well,
there
were talks. Everyone was baffled that it wasn't behind closed doors.
But closed doors games are always weird as hell anyway. Like, you really want to play a closed doors game? And even then, they still have to go to the stadium.
That's what I was going
to
say.
It's not.
Overall, it was quite a remarkable, like, following that on Saturday evening and seeing the reports and stuff. It was quite a remarkable situation then. For it to be rescheduled and postponed again was...
The fact that they tried to play it the next day was just baffling. It was like, no, what are you doing? But, just cancel it.
But I think we will cancel this episode as well on that, because we did the extra. We did the extra, but I think that's plenty of noise from us. So last, just say thank you for joining me, Mo.
Thank you so much for joining me, Mo.
Yeah. And Will, thank you. Don't make a funny joke.
Okay, I won't.
Bye. And with that perfect ending, that's it for this week. See you next week, guys.